KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, comedian Caitlin Brodnick had a double mastectomy at the age of 28 without a cancer diagnosis. She did have the BRCA1 gene mutation that doctors said gave her a more than 80% chance of having breast cancer. Brodnick let a camera crew document her surgery in an online series for Glamour magazine that had more than 7 million views. She now has a book that has, as she puts it, all the gritty details of her experience. It's called Dangerous Boobies, Breaking Up With My Time Bomb Breasts. Brodnick joins us next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, you're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. After actor Angelina Jolie shared that she'd had a double mastectomy because she carried a gene mutation that put her at higher risk of breast cancer, screening for the gene shot up dramatically. My guest, Caitlin Brodnick, writes, "Jolie opened the door, I'll give you the grand tour." Brodnick, like Jolie, decided to have a preventative double mastectomy, and she shared her experience in an online series for Glamour magazine. Brodnick's new book, called Dangerous Boobies, Breaking Up With My Time Bomb Breasts, gets even more personal, telling readers how she agonized over her decision to have the surgery, her life post-mastectomy, and her complicated relationship with her breasts. Brodnick is a comedian, writer, and public speaker. Welcome to Forum.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited.
Well, thank you for being here. I have to ask you first, how did you settle on the title?
I love titles. There were so many. I thought like maybe a title of it.
Bleep.
Other bad words. And so I have a really dirty mouth. But I just, Dangerous Boobies was just that's how they feel. They felt really dangerous my whole life.
Yes. You talk about how it felt like at any moment they could completely take over your life. And in a sense, they did.
They completely have. And my life is so much better without them, which is like a bizarre thing. Like if you had told me this when I was in my teens, like one day you'll remove your breasts and you'll never feel better. And you'll really feel like a full, strong woman. I wouldn't have believed you. I would have thought it was like confusing. And it was wonderful. But yeah, growing up, I was in a family that was like split 50-50 Jewish Catholic. And my dad's the only surviving person in his family. He's lost both parents and both sisters to cancer. So growing up, we were attending a ton of funerals. It was just very much a part of our lives. And we have this thing in our family. We say like, we're great at funerals. Like if you need someone to come to a funeral, we've figured it out. We know what to do. And I was born 9 months after his sister died of breast cancer at 33. So I came into the world very aware of cancer, very aware of breast cancer, and just had an understanding of it. And so those fears that were with me for the second I understood what cancer was.
Yes, your aunt died at the age of 33. You were born 9 months later. And in some ways, you almost felt like you were like, viewed as a reincarnation of your aunt.
Yeah, they were like, you're just like her. And all I saw were these pictures of her. She looked really puffy. And I was like, I wanted to look like Kelly Kapowski. Like, that's what I wanted to have, like, you know, my future to be like. And it was a really sad story. So it made me very anxious as a child.
Well, first, tell us what the BRCA1 gene mutation is.
Okay, so first of all, I'm not an actual doctor, so this is my understanding of it. Everyone has the BRCA mutation 1 and 2. We all have it. It stands for breast cancer gene. I'm sorry. We all have the gene. If you have the mutation, that's when somebody says to you casually, oh, I'm positive for BRCA1 or positive for BRCA2, they're talking about that they have a mutated version of the gene. The gene is used as a protein suppressor, so it helps suppress cancer growth. And in our bodies, all of our cells know what to do. They, like, if you, like, you know, you scrape your lip and it heals quicker than if you hurt your elbow. Like, all of our cells work with this code. And basically, if you have the mutation, that means that your body is less likely to handle a cancer cell, a rogue cell, and it's more difficult for that for your body to fight that off. And so the chance of it growing and developing are much higher than someone who doesn't have a mutated version of the gene.
So you knew that your father's family, that he'd lost all of his immediate family members to cancer, that you had this aunt who died of breast cancer, and you had this sense that there was some kind of impending doom potentially on your body, and yet you didn't want to get tested for it. Why not? Why not get tested for the BRCA1 gene mutation?
My dad figured it out about like 15 years ago. He was very early to find out about it because he had to figure it out that it couldn't just be bad luck. There had to be a reason that he lost his whole family to this. And he's in the medical industry and he was right. He just knew it. And so he felt very hopeful and thought we should all get tested. And if there's a cause, there's a solution. And I was 21 and I just met the cutest boy in the world and I was madly in love. And I was like, why? Like, why would I want... I felt like cancer was always there. Why would I want almost like a certificate of approval that like cancer was closer?
You write about this in your book, and I think this is the passage that you wanted to share with us. Mm-hmm. Would you like to read it to us now?
Sure. My sister took the blood test for BRCA one spring break when she was home from college, because of course she did. She is great at that stuff. Once again, she was being the perfect daughter. And guess what? She was negative for the gene. Negative, as in does not have to worry, does not have a higher risk of breast cancer, and does not have to give it another thought. I still wasn't having it. My dad pushed me for years, but I was obstinate. My dad even bought me one of the first DNA testing kits, the one that used a swab instead of a needle, and you could send it off by mail and get your results. I kept that kit behind closed doors of my overstuffed closet under a pile of Halloween wigs. I hated that kit. It just sat there waiting with its passive-aggressive whispers of impending doom.
And that passage also gives us a sense of the sort of the style of the book. You want it to be not light, but you wanted it to be really honest, like a friend talking to another friend about this.
Yeah, I felt like, thank you. I really wanted that when I was going through it. At the time, I wasn't connected to any support groups, and I didn't really feel like I could walk into a cancer center. I didn't want to take a time away from women who actually had cancer. That was a big part of this for me, is that I didn't have cancer. I did a preventative option, and I felt sort of fraudulent. I felt like I didn't want to go to a cancer support group because that wasn't my group, and then I felt very uncomfortable, and all I wanted was like a girlfriend to say, oh, I've been there. This is what happens. Get your nails done before surgery because they'll put an IV in and you'll love looking at your pretty nails. Like, I wanted something light and casual. And, you know, there's a lot of great things online you can read. There's some wonderful medical abstracts, some wonderful books, but all of that just felt too heavy for me at the time. There was nothing humorous. There was nothing light. And I think at that age, I really wanted... If I had seen a book like this, if my dad had asked me to get tested at 21, but he had handed me a book like this, I would have been like, okay, this is a way I can slowly get acclimated to the process. You know, it feels, there are a bunch of, I'm like, try to pack it with laughs because I was like, this medical stuff's intense. Sometimes you need a break. Sometimes you need to talk about like constipation after surgery, which is real and yes. Like and preventable. But I did have a ton of incredibly smart doctors and scientists give me blurbs and review. And I just kept going back over with my doctors to make sure that it was all medically sound, because I could just chat forever, but I wanted to make sure all of it was correct.
Well, the other thing too, though, is, and you've talked about having great doctors, but the way you found out sounded like a really negative experience. So first, tell us what made you eventually decide to get tested, and then what your experience was when you were told your diagnosis.
So I decided I was going to get tested because I was young and I wanted to leave my career as a receptionist and focus full-time on comedy and auditioning as a career, which makes no money, but I was ready to go. But I was afraid I'd lose my health insurance. So I figured before I make this incredible change, let me just see if I have like a life-threatening disease. Let me just like go in, check it out.
You were about 28 years old.
Yeah. When I first got tested, I was like 25.
Yes, that's right. You had the surgery at 28.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I went in for a gluten allergy because it's the most popular allergy in 2011. And I was like, and the doctor was like, no, you probably could have BRCA, when I gave her my family history and all the things I'd gone through. But the news was delivered to me by a very intense breast surgeon who was just so harsh and basically said, oh, we'll just cut off your breasts if you're positive. And then left the room and then came back and gave me my paperwork and said, I'll leave you alone again. And I'm there. I just felt like I was in a horror film. Like, I was completely isolated. I was sweating through my clothes. I felt like everything we were afraid of as a family had come true. And I called my family and just started crying. I couldn't even break the news to my dad. I made my mom tell him because it just felt like the monster that was under the bed was now like in the room with us planning our demise. It was so overwhelming.
We're talking with comedian and writer Caitlin Brodnick, who found out when she was 25 that she carried a gene mutation that gave her an 87% chance of getting breast cancer in her lifetime. Brodnick had a preventative double mastectomy, and her new book about the experience is called Dangerous Boobies, Breaking Up with My Time Bomb Breasts. So we alluded to this earlier in terms of your complicated relationship with your breasts, but can you just help our listeners understand what made it so complicated for
you? They were massive. They were humongous. They were, you know what? They were a fan favorite. People loved them. Girls were amazed by them. Guys couldn't get enough of them. I'm like almost like 5'1", like 5'1" and a half. I'm a very short person, and they were 32G, sometimes F if I like had too many burritos.
So if for those who don't understand how bra sizes work.
Oh, so they are just like two watermelons attached to my body. And really, it was
but it goes like A to G. I mean, it goes to A to, whatever.
And the most common is like A to D. Like, that's what you find in stores. I could not find any bras in stores. I had to have them specially ordered. They were so massive that I would, to walk around and not be just a complete sex object, I'd have to wear like a compression bra and then a tank top and then a V-neck shirt to not have a uniboob. Like, it was like five different layers just to leave the house, and then I'd be sweating. So it's like, what's the point? And if you put a blazer on me, I looked like a linebacker. Like, it just, I never felt proud or confident in my body, except when I was having sex, because then it's like, okay, you're doing your job, girls. Like, let's enjoy the party. But otherwise, since I wasn't doing it all the time, you know, I had to leave the house. It was tough.
But and you talked about just wishing that they were smaller, they were more normal sized.
Yeah, I always wanted, like, instead of a Russian nesting doll, I wanted like a Russian ballerina breast. Like, I just wanted something light. And, you know, seeing girls that could wear like any like words on their shirt, like all of the words on my shirt looked, made everybody look a little dyslexic because it was like very confusing. And I just felt like everything was so over sexualized. And that was what I really hated. Like, I want to be sexy when I want to be it, but I don't want to just be carrying these around. They hurt my back. I have a little scoliosis. So the whole deal was difficult.
And yet when you were presented with the possibility, right, of having a double mastectomy and then being able to, I guess, reconstruct your breast to some degree, that had some appeal. But for the most part, you really initially decided no, right?
No. Initially, I mean, I am not a fan of hospitals and doctors. I am not good at needles. I see needles and I faint. Somebody, if I get my blood drawn, I'm about to pass out or throw up. So I, at first, did not want to be a part of that medical world. I didn't want to go to, I went to Sloan Kettering Memorial Cancer Center and Memorial Sloan Kettering.
Kettering, yes.
Yeah, and they were wonderful. But, you know, when you go into that cancer center, there's other cancer patients that are getting treatment, that are fighting for their lives. And I really, as a young woman, didn't want to be a part of the club. You know, I felt, I'd seen so much of it growing up that I thought almost if I had agreed to the mastectomy, then I was in the cancer community, which I really didn't want to be a part of. It also just felt like too much to handle. So instead, I just got drunk for 3 years. I just got trashed. I really didn't take care of myself. I felt, you know, when someone gives you this crazy high percentage, at the time they told me I had an 87% chance of getting breast cancer in my lifetime. And that is just such a bizarre sensation to have someone tell you a high, high chance that you could get cancer. And in my family's case, that just means death. Mm-hmm. So giving me this sort of like death sentence, you rarely get that on a piece of paper. You rarely have somebody slide your folder over to you and it's that severe. You know, they could say, oh, you could be, you know, pre-diabetic, or you should watch out for heart disease because of your family. But to have those statistics, that's why I wish I'd gone to a genetic counselor at first, because it's basically like an incredible scientist and therapist mix in one. And they explain everything that is going on in your body, every sort of like the plan for your future, when the cancer really starts to become, you know, it doesn't create, the chances rise as you get older. So how you would communicate with your family, everything like that. But I didn't have that experience at first. So that first experience was just terrifying. And I just wanted to drink all my problems away.
Yes, you actually talk about how there was a struggle for you to stop it. You eventually did and realized what effect it had been having on you. What made you ultimately decide to do the double mastectomy?
I was getting my photos taken as an actress, so getting my headshots taken, and the entire time I could not, the breasts were taking over the photos. Like, it just was ruining everything. You know, you have an 8x10 photo of yourself, and half of that was cleavage for me. And it just, I felt so uncomfortable, so unhappy. And I remember I was sitting in the back of a cab on the way home saying, I can't wait till I'm like in my 50s and 60s and I can finally have the mastectomy. Because at the time, doctors had said to me, it's not recommended until you're older, after you've breastfed, when your risks really start to rise. But then my other thought was like, why? That was like a feeling of freedom and relief, that imagining myself when I'm older. And I was like, why can't that start now? Why do I have to love my body and love my breasts when I'm in my 50s? And I was like, I'm like 27, 28. I should be feeling good. Like, I should be liking this body. I know that it's young and cute and it's not going to be around forever.
What was the hardest part about having the procedure?
I think the hardest part was the fact that there's a lot in your control in the beginning, getting tested, talking about your family, planning the surgery, and then you really have to let everything go and just hope that it works out well. And, you know, I was saying, like, I wish I had been awake during the surgery, or like send my doctors like a video they could play of me just being like, you know, girls, you're doing great. I'm really proud of you. Like, I wanted to be a part of it. But you just put your fate in their hands. And I had some amazing doctors, but still at the same time, that feeling of like letting go when the surgery was happening was really hard. I know, because I was younger, that, and from my experience with like my father's physical therapist and his practice, younger patients heal quicker. So I knew that I'd heal pretty well. I had a good feeling about it, but still just the unknown of just giving your body over to science, really.
I watched some of the videos from your Glamour online series that you did, and it struck me that though you knew you were younger and would heal quickly, that you were a little surprised at how difficult the healing process was.
Well, I'd never had surgery before. I'd heard some women talk about healing after surgery or healing after they had babies, and I haven't given birth. And so I didn't know how long it takes your body to heal internally and how exhausting it can be on you. So I mentally felt like I should have been better and back fighting and ready to go in a matter of weeks, when my body was still like, no, something intense just happened. Like, we got to go slowly. And so that was what was really difficult for me, is not knowing too many people who had done it at the time in 2013. That was right when Angelina came out with it.
Right. So you'd already been grappling with it before her piece in the New York Times.
Yeah. And then it was sort of like, oh, if Angelina Jolie's doing it and her body is constantly sexualized, it's all over. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, there's something about it where it's like, if she like makes her money on being completely sexual and using her breasts to her power, and if she's getting it, I'm like, I hate them anyway. Like, I'm not doing anything with them. So that was a positive feeling that I had of being like, yeah, let's just get the surgery and finish. But yeah, I had no experience in surgery and healing from anything. I had never, thank God, broken a bone. I was like, I'm an indoor kid. So I was nervous about all of that and just grappling with healing.
How did you make the decision to use implants as opposed to, there are, I guess, different options out there? And
there
what
are.
Is the process?
There's two different options for implants right now, maybe possibly three. There's silicone or saline, and then you could also do something that where you use your fat and muscle. No, I'm sorry, not muscle, fat and tissue from your body to rebuild your breasts. And that sounded really good at first, because I was like, oh, I have like a nice little tummy. We'll like put it all up in my boobs, and that's like a win-win. But my doctor was saying, because I hadn't had children yet and I'm planning on having children, that when you do that surgery, it makes everything there very tight. It's sort of, you take a lot of tissue. And so she said you want that to be roomy for when you want to have kids. And a lot of women do it after they have children, because it's like an amazing tummy tuck as well. It's like such a good solution. But she said for me, also the breasts that I wanted to look like. So that's really interesting too, is that I had this opportunity to be like, oh, who are the women that I love their breasts? Like who are my favorite breasted celebrities? Like, you're just like, it's a very bizarre place to be. So it turns out I like a very like perky circular breast that is just light and easy. And so we went with silicone, and it was wonderful. She picked I really let her do a lot of the decision making.
Your doctor?
Yeah, my doctor, because she knows what she's doing. She's done this all the time. This is her. She gets up and goes to work, and this is her job. It's not my job, so I don't know what I'm talking about. And it was great.
So from the time that you finished the mastectomy to the time that you were able to get the implants and healed, about how long did that take?
So there's two surgeries. First, the mastectomy is they remove all of the breast tissue. But it's not like they used to do years ago with our grandmothers that was it was called a radical mastectomy, where sometimes they would take the chest wall, or they would take a lot of things that weren't necessary. Since this is a genetic-based cancer, that they only take what – sorry, I'm spacing.
Oh, no, that's okay.
So basically
the tissue
they only took
it,
the tissue from
like.
Yeah, they only took the tissue from the breast.
And the implant is then placed actually behind your pectoral
behind
muscle.
Behind the pec muscle, yes.
So, you know, you've been able to talk about this in a way that helps to make the experience as not overwhelming and frightening to women who may be approaching this decision. Do you ever worry that or have been accused of making it sound too light or too?
Yeah. I mean, I always say this is not the best decision for everyone. I do not think this is the way to go for everybody. I have friends that like love their breasts and have a very deep connection with them and feel that it's a major part of their sexuality. So I don't know if this process would be the same for them. I also don't, there people have had surgical complications and it hasn't gone very well. So I'm not saying this is like a perfect solution, but if you do choose to have this surgery, I wanted there to be an easier, softer manual.
And the concerns that there were concerns after Angelina Jolie came out that maybe women would choose this when they didn't really need it, or that it was they were not realizing just how significant the procedure was.
That was definitely in the very beginning when I first got tested as well, before even pre-Angelina. It was that a lot of doctors were nervous at their patients because it's also such an emotional journey you take when you get this information. They didn't want everyone rushing into it and then regretting it and having this huge regret. So whenever I speak to friends of mine or someone asking me about it, I always say, like, you know, if you can take a couple more months of therapy, if you want to talk to people, the thing is, if you just have a high risk of cancer, it doesn't mean you have cancer yet. So I keep trying to explain that to my friends. Like, you don't have cancer today. If it took me 3 years to come to the decision, a lot of tears, a lot of feelings, a lot of going over and over with family members and significant others. And so I always say that, like, take your time with the decision, even though it feels so intense and the feelings are there. Really check all of your options.
We're talking with Caitlin Brodnick. Her book is Dangerous Boobies, Breaking Up with My Time Bomb Breasts. Caitlin Brodnick elected to have a double mastectomy after she learned that she carried the BRCA gene mutation that gave her a more than 80% chance of getting breast cancer in her lifetime. Join the conversation. What are your questions for Caitlin Brodnick? Do you have breast cancer in your family? Is this something that you have considered? What do you wish you knew beforehand? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. Post them on Facebook, on Twitter. We're at KQED Forum. Or email us at forum@kqed.org. More with Caitlin Brodnick after the break. I'm Mina Kim. Stay with us. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with comedian and writer and public speaker Caitlin Brodnick. She found out when she was in her mid-20s that she carried a gene mutation, the BRCA1 gene mutation, that gave her a more than 80% chance of getting breast cancer. And she's written a book about her experiences having a double mastectomy, a preemptive double mastectomy. And the book is called Dangerous Boobies, Breaking Up with My Time Bomb Breasts. Caitlin Brodnick will also be speaking at Book Passage in Corte Madera tomorrow at 1 p.m. And she did a series for Glamour Magazine in 2013 documenting her surgery that we also have online at forum@kqed.org. We'd like you, our listeners, to join the conversation with your questions. That number again, 866-733-6786. And you can find us on Facebook, Twitter. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website. Robert asks, could Ms. Brodnick describe how a young performing artist could pay for the procedures and clinicians she relied upon? Considering the previous hour's subject and discussion, I'm happy that Ms. Brodnick's circumstances afforded a comic the insurance coverage she must have required to act on her decisions, or cash she must have required to act on her decisions.
Yeah, that's an amazing question. So money is a huge part. I have a chapter in that. But
you do.
It's difficult. It's really difficult. So at the time, when you are test positive for the mutation, you basically get a green light to be able to go to way more tests, to get way more surveillance, and to really get taken care of and looked at in a more sophisticated way relating to cancer. So the surgery is covered under insurance, and any reconstruction needs, if there was something that happened during surgery and they have to correct things, all of that is covered by insurance. And employers aren't allowed to discriminate against you. There's all these wonderful acts that are coming through that are helping people to take care of themselves. I actually think insurance companies, they might hate me saying this, but they'd rather you have a surgery than go through cancer treatment, because it's so much more expensive to go through cancer treatment. So this surgery is less for them. And then the copays were expensive. I had to pay them off over time. If there was any like Christmas gift or anything from families, I'd put it towards the surgery. And so if I could get help, I'd get it. But also the hospital was really lovely and worked with me and understood my financial burden. And so over time, I just slowly paid for one of the surgeries, yeah.
Yes, and one of the things that you also talk about is really helping you through this whole process was just support from friends and family, mm-hmm. emotional as well as...
Yeah, that was really the only way I could have done it, because there were so many times where you just... I had no idea what surgery was like and how to heal and what to expect. And I had all these expectations when doctors said, oh, you can work out in 6 weeks. I thought... You could work out in 6 weeks meant you'd be happy in 6 weeks. You'd feel strong in your body. You could going at full speed again. You know, you could be back to running around and being an artist. And that wasn't the case. So technically, my scars had healed, but my body was still very slow. I was still very tired. I mentally just felt so different. I felt very other at the time. Like, I'd gone through this huge surgery and I couldn't really connect the way I did with people before. So it really,
there was a certain sadness you write about.
There was. It was really hard for me. It was hard for me to, I'm a happy, perky person. I'm a comedian and I don't want to be a bummer. And all I did was feel like a bummer. I just felt tired. I felt slow. I do suffer from depression and anxiety. So that was also, of course, there and a part of it. And I didn't, when I was imagining the surgery, I didn't think that those guys would come aboard. But
and that lasted about how long?
I think it was like a couple months. And I felt incredible and right back to my intense fighting self a year later. But I think, like, for me, it took me, my body to heal, like maybe 6 months, which was really hard. And you don't want to hear that when you're about to do the surgery. All I wanted to focus on was that I could exercise in 6 weeks again. Even though the doctor said everyone's different, I didn't realize how my body and how I would mentally respond to it.
Well, we've got calls coming in. Let's start with Linda from Napa. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for answering my call. I'm totally blown away by this conversation. My entire body is tingling. I had repeating cancer metastasized and opted for a transplant, which you must know.
Mm-hmm. I'm so sorry.
I'm listening to you. I'm so shocked at my response. I really thought that everything was status quo, okay, but literally I can feel this in my entire body. And I want to say I have tremendous respect for you.
I am
blown away that you could even make a decision like that, because it was hard to make it when I was faced with fourth stage cancer. And to make it on the basis of those statistics, kudos to you. So I have a couple questions for you. When I went in to speak about my options, I walked away with this feeling of, oh my God, this tramp flap is so wonderful. It just takes part of your body and restructure it. And and you have you spoke about the tummy tuck. Mm-hmm. Oh, it was so much more than that. I cannot tell you how much more than that it was. And I have to say, it took me years to get over a lot of anger around that I thought I was going to walk out of there, you know, scot-free with a tummy tuck. I'm thin anyway, so who cared? But it was partly the romance of that, and you talked about the new boobs, and it was also partly the romance of that. So I have to live with the ancillary issues of that, which are really pretty life altering.
Of course.
And I wanted to know if your doctors were really clear with you, especially the ones that you grew to respect and like, on, you know, the possibilities. It's not going to be the way your body is, period. Was, I should say. And the genetic testing, it was suggested that my girls get tested because my maternal grandmothers both died of cancer. And I have not passed that on because I'm so freaked out about it.
Well, Linda,
and so go ahead.
Thank you for sharing. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm sorry you had to go through all of this. It's so difficult and so traumatic and so long. I think that's the thing, is that I didn't expand on this, but another reason I didn't want to do that type of surgery that you're talking about. So they removed the tissue, and instead of having like a small scar, the scar is really all the way across your waist. It's like a lower abdomen cesarean scar. It almost looks like the old-fashioned cesarean scars.
You're talking about what Linda had.
What Linda had, yes. Which is the deep flap, or it's where they take tissue from your body and build breasts with it.
Yes.
So with that comes a lot of risks of heavy scar tissue. And basically, when they rebuild your breast, there are a lot more scarring in areas that could have infection, or it could be hard for a certain body area of your body to take. And then you're healing very slowly. And so physically, not only are you out from the mastectomy, you're exhausted also because it's a major, major surgery for your abdomen. And that's very hard for people to heal from emotionally, mentally, physically, because it's one thing to be able to like swing your legs out of bed, but have a hard time lifting your arms. You really feel like you can't move a lot of your body. And that's very hard, very emotional, and a totally different process. My doctors did explain that to me, and I, being like nervous about surgery to begin with, that was also something that I did not want to have. I wanted to have one procedure, you know, in my case two, you know, you have two different surgeries, but I just wanted to have one area that I have to focus on instead of also worrying about everything else. And then also to answer a question about her children, it is incredibly difficult and overwhelming. And I too, like, think about what I'll tell my kids, but they don't usually recommend it until they're in their 20s, probably past 21. And then at the same time, I would always say there's some amazing genetic counselors. So you can also sort of look them up, Google, ask friends, and try and find somebody that you know that will deliver this information in a way that is helpful. And then there's always, I needed therapy.
Well, there's one thing that struck me in your book, which is that you commented on how the doctors that you ended up choosing to do your double mastectomy and their reconstruction surgery, that you liked their shoes and their choice of clothes. And I know that sounds funny, but what I liked about that, right, was you were essentially telling women to trust their instincts about people, because it can be very intimidating to be in a situation where you have these experts, right? And you feel like they must know a lot more than you, that it's easy for women to kind of ignore maybe the parts of them that are saying, but I just feel better with this person.
So my thing too is that I am intimidated by doctors and these amazing medical minds, and they've gone through years and years of school. They know exactly what they're talking about, and I don't know. You know, I'm a comedian. I'm just a lay person. I don't know how the procedure's done. So for me, I wanted to look for warm, fuzzy, comfortable people. Men or women, it didn't matter. It turns out it was all female, which is also a bonus. I loved it. But I even, for me, I hunted on message boards, Facebook groups, Twitter. I just tried to find mentions of these doctors. And if any doctor was mentioned out of the hospital I was choosing, I like Googled them all. And if any doctor was mentioned to have like poor bedside manner or rushed you out or made you feel uncomfortable, that was a no-go. I knew that I needed a warm, fuzzy, sensitive doctor, and they were also brilliant, so it was wonderful.
Yes, you validated your own instincts. Chris in Discovery Bay. Hi, Chris.
I had breast cancer when I was 36 in 1989.
And so sorry.
I had a mastectomy because of where the tumor was located. I've never had a reconstruction because I didn't want to have any more surgery, and it is just fine. So my message in having breast cancer is not the absolute worst thing, And being afraid of it actually hurts your immune system, which is going to be fighting the cells that might want to become cancerous.
Chris, thanks for making that point.
I agree. I think I think a lot of healing from breast cancer and breast cancer treatment, a lot of it is mental. There's like some amazing procedures and things have grown so fast and science is speeding up. That was one of the things that I didn't know if I was able to do. I didn't know if I got cancer, if I would have been emotionally and mentally strong enough. That's a huge part of it. And after growing up with all of my family members, ones that were the most important people to me passing away from cancer, I was afraid and really felt like if I got it, it would have been like, oh, here, we all knew it would happen. This is how I go. And I don't think I would have been as strong and fighting as some of these amazing women that I know that can do it. And I also think every decision's right for the right person. You know, like everybody feels some women don't want to have reconstruction. Some women do. Some women are more comfortable going to screenings twice a year and having that risk of maybe they will have it, maybe they won't, but they'll keep their body healthy. I ended up not going to any of the doctor's appointments. I was scheduled to go twice a year to check because my, breasts were at high risk. I just didn't go. I was too afraid. So I wasn't doing a good job.
Well, what are some of the considerations that you still have now in terms of your health, right? Like you have talked about how after you got the surgery and after you have the implants, that there is a loss of feeling. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit about what are some considerations that will be lifelong for you?
Sure. So when you have the mastectomy surgery, the preventative mastectomy, when they take the tissue out, they also sever nerves. So right after the surgery, you do not have any feeling around your breast area. And so doctors say, be careful with heating pads, be careful with cooking over a hot flame, be careful with underwire bras because it could poke you and you not feel it. So now a lot of my feeling has come back and it just feels, my breasts now feel like the top of my forearm. Like if you touch your forearm, you can feel the skin, you can feel like that top layer, but then it presses into bone. You can't feel anything in your bone. And sort of that's how the implant is. Like I feel the top layer and then once it gets to the implant, nothing's there. So that is lovely. I still go once a year to get checked to make sure if they feel any bizarre bump or if something magically grew, that would be terrifying. And then I do have to get screening for ovarian cancer as well, because being positive for BRCA1 and 2 mutation, you also have a very high risk of ovarian cancer. That isn't something that I've addressed that often because I'm very overwhelmed by it. And so I'm like, I'm going to handle the boobs and then I'll handle the ovaries next.
I was going to ask you whether that's something that has had the same effect on you as breast cancer, or concerns about breast cancer?
It hasn't had the same effect as, for the reason that so many of my family members died of breast cancer. Breast cancer was a big, huge part of my life. Luckily, knock on wood, I don't have any family members that have passed from ovarian cancer. But let's say you have an immediate family member that's struggling with ovarian cancer, those are one of the reasons why people get tested. They want to know, is it genetic? Is it sort of a fluke? The sad thing about ovarian cancer is that it's so difficult to detect. A lot of the symptoms feel like period symptoms, or just you feel bloated or some weird pain. And mostly it's hard to detect, and so they don't figure it out until the cancer is more mature. Because the screening, as I've talked to some scientists and doctors, they said just isn't there yet. It's on its way. They're working on it. We'll get there eventually. But that is why it's considered a more deadly cancer, because you don't get it as early. You don't figure it out as early as you could figure out with breast cancer.
Well, let's go to more calls. Eva in Oakland. Hi, Eva.
Hi. Hi. Hey, I just really wanted to thank you for telling your story.
Thank you.
I'm also a previvor, which is a term that we don't hear that frequently. But I was 35 when I had the double mastectomy with reconstruction, and I actually did the deep. Mm. So I used my own tissue, which was kind of my preference. I'm very active and I play softball, and one shot on a bad hop into the breast, and I was just concerned about
it. Yeah,
what that would look like. But I guess what I'm finding is that if I tell somebody about this, they're like, oh, like Angelina Jolie. Mm. And for me, as a kind of non-celebrity and a queer person, I felt like there were not a lot of people who were telling this story. And the whole thing, everything you described, from finding out and sharing it with your parents. My parents have been gone for a long time, but sorry. just just that process of like, okay, well, what comes next? Mm-hmm. And for me, like you, I was not interested in having a double mastectomy, basically, until I found out that my risk was 87% with right. highly aggressive breast cancer. And, you know, to think about going through chemo and radiation and what my mom had gone through, mm-hmm. it just felt like, well, I want to be alive. Mm-hmm. And this is one way that I get to choose that, because, you know, we don't know what happens in life. Mm-hmm. This is one way that we could choose to be alive for ourselves and people who love us. And so I just wanted to thank you for being another voice to raise awareness to this. And I also, a friend of mine is creating a documentary about other folks who have BRCA mutations who have gone through this process. And so she's been documenting my process through my surgeries.
Great.
And yeah. So
we need more people.
Exactly. And I'm glad that you're out there, and I'm glad that you're connecting with other folks who are having this, because I think it's really important for those of us who have such a strong family history.
Thank you.
My only other comment is that, you know, for me, it took a couple surgeons to find the one that I trusted to
yes.
do this.
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone has a different bedside manner mm-hmm. and a different idea of what they think is right. And I also feel so thankful that I found somebody who, you know, really saw me and held my hand through the process alongside my friends and community.
Eva, thanks so much. It almost sounds like it very much sounds like your story to some mm-hmm. degree, and also even the fact of sharing it while you're going through the process. You were talking about how that sort of forced you to kind of bring your best self, or
yes.
just sort of get out of bed and put the lipstick on and
yes.
and do it. Robert writes, electing to get a double mastectomy is a draconian solution to a potential problem. 87% is not 100%. Mm-hmm. You have time before a cancer develops, if it develops at all. In the meantime, a cancer preventative or cure may be developed. Why not wait a few years?
Well, I think it's a decision for everyone. It's a personal decision. I mean, when you see someone go through cancer, seeing my family members, how quickly it spread to their lymph nodes, how quickly they would have to go right into chemo treatment, how, you know, they'd have a port in their arm and then not able to move it and it would get swelling. I mean, the experience that I had in my life was just so different. You know, you could make a mathematic problem and say, oh, the probability is not 100%, and that's fine. And he's entitled to his opinion, but he did not spend 25 years talking about cancer and death and going to funerals. It changes your mind.
Which is really what you're pointing out in your book, is that for you, it was influenced your decision by just so many aspects mm-hmm. of being who you are. I found it so interesting, and I hope it's okay to share this, that you decided in the end, when you did reconstruction, to not reconstruct a nipple.
Yeah.
That you went, no nipple.
I can't pick a nipple to save my life. There's so many choices.
But I found that so interesting, because in reading your book, you know, initially you really described yourself as someone who tried hard to manipulate and shrink and hide your breasts
yes.
to conform to some more normal-looking sense of what you thought was normal.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you decided, you know what, I'm totally fine with a breast without a nipple. Did you feel like that was like a, I don't know, that you hit a new level?
I mean, that sounds great. No, I was also like, I couldn't pick a nipple. It's like, I can barely figure out what to eat. Like, I never know what to order for dinner. And like, there's so many amazing artists. There's tattoo artists. There's that your doctor can reconstruct a nipple from your own tissue. It was just like, it was like a kid in a candy store. And it was like, I didn't know. I wasn't prepared. And I didn't know if like I needed like more mature, like grandma looking nipples I could grow into. Or like if I had itty bitty Coachella nipples that like just saw the sun for the first time. Like I couldn't handle it. It was too much.
Well, Eleni writes, I'm a breast cancer survivor with a single mastectomy on the left side mm-hmm. and got an implant. I always use humor when talking about my experience. I answer the age-old question, was it, what is better, fake or real? I say both. Akilah in Cupertino. What's on your mind, Akilah?
Hi. So I'm a breast cancer survivor. I actually was pregnant with my baby
Congrats.
When I got diagnosed. And my baby is now 8 years old.
Yeah.
It's doing just fine. And for me, the whole experience, I can relate completely. And I'm really glad that you're bringing it up today as a discussion, because there are so many people out there that are using your voice to share their opinion.
Thank you
so much.
And
share their thoughts. So It's pretty close to my heart because I got diagnosed pretty young as well. Mm-hmm. And a lot of things that you are sharing in your experience in your book are very close to what I felt and completely can relate to what you're talking about. The one question that I had was, as I was going through the process, and I actually had amazing doctors. I got diagnosed in Portland, Oregon, and mm-hmm. I was treated in Providence, St. Vincent. And the doctors there, one of the suggestions that they had made was, you know, we go through infusion, we go through a lot of chemo processes, mm-hmm. and I was also a dancer, so I had to put on, you know, get my own hair wig done mm-hmm. in Florida for like $1,000, and that went out of my own pocket. So there's a lot of things that were completely new to me that I went around, you know, finding out the information, asking around, and what I did find was there was some discussions about alternate healing processes mm-hmm. and something called Reiki. I don't know if you've heard it mm-hmm. before. Mm-hmm. Is they actually come to the infusion clinic and they sit down with you as you're going through chemo. Mm-hmm. And there's a process where they touch your hand and you can literally feel the positive energy go through yeah. your body. And there was a lot of support around that and yoga and meditation. So I just wanted to share that thought and also find out from you, like you had mentioned that when you were healing from your mastectomies, you know, the process took you longer than you thought and mm-hmm. it felt the same way for me. And I wanted to know, because I used to go to a corner of my house and just sit down and bawl away crying mm-hmm. for no reason.
Of course.
And I understand you also went through some of that. And mm. how did you heal? Like, what were your different other processes for healing?
Akilah, thank you.
I'll give my response off here.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
What tips for healing?
So for healing, I didn't do it very well. I wasn't very good at it. I didn't really know how and exactly what I should do. I just really wanted to comfort myself. My major things were eating Caesar salad and spaghetti in bed. I mean, it was like, I wasn't that good at it. And my mom actually made me get up, put on shoes and leave the house. And at the time I was like, you are a monster. How could you make me leave my house? I was like, just like, I'm a bed person now. I sleep in this bed and that's all we do. But walking around and leaving the house and just moving my body, what really helped me was being a part of the world again and seeing that everyone else is going on with their lives and I'm not so special. like feeling like I was just like one of the group, you know, like everyone on my street was doing the same thing. The dry cleaners was doing this, like everything was normal and I had changed. And that was kind of lovely, is that the world wasn't closing in on me. I was just healing and this is temporary. So for me, being around people, being around friends, and yeah, doing the documentary Screw You Cancer, when the camera crew was like in my home, I was like, all right, I'm going to put on lipstick. I'm going to be a reporter for all those girls that are terrified, because I was terrified. And it gave me a job to do. So that was healing. And the book was very healing because I am dyslexic and I wasn't the strongest reader. And I was intimidated by books and I never thought I could do anything like this. But as I was going on, I just kept saying, this isn't about me anymore. This is about the girl. This is what I wanted when I was about to go through surgery or even testing. This is about the girl who's scared alone, who doesn't want to walk into a cancer center, but you can pick up a book and read one chapter. You can read the chapter about sex because everyone wants to know what's sex like after surgery.
Yes, and you do write about that.
I do.
In great detail.
I do. That's all I cared about.
Yes. You know, also, Akilah mentioned that she has a baby, and you mentioned at the break that
yes,
you're pregnant. So
I am
wanted
pregnant
to congratulate
too.
You. And I also remember in the book that you talked about one of the worries you had was that you wouldn't be able to nurse. And is that
yes.
something that you've made peace with?
Yes. So at first, I was nervous about even talking to my husband. We were first married. I was worried to say, you know, he loves everything natural. He loves everything organic. Once I gave our plant cheap fertilizer and he got very upset. And I was like, oh my gosh, is this going to be how it is? Like, if I get the surgery, is he going to think I'm giving my baby fertilizer formula? Like, is it going to be terrible? And then when I finally explained it to him, he's like, oh, who cares? Like, I was formula fed. And I was like, oh, I was formula fed. And so we talked about that. And at the time of the surgery, I was so peaceful about it. Then as soon as I got pregnant, I got this flood of hormones. And I remember I had one night where I was like, I'm a terrible human. Like, I'm a bad mom before I'm even a mom. Like, I was feeling all this guilty. And my husband had to say, like, no, it took you a very long time to come to this decision. You are really happy. This is just a moment. And it was true. Like, I just had a moment of freak out. And then the next thing I knew, I was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to be around for a long time for this kid, too. Like, he's never going to have to go with me to cancer treatments for breast cancer. And, like, it made me feel so much better. But there are those moments, there are those hormonal moments. Like, in this interview, at times I was spacing out because pregnancy brain is real. And sometimes I don't know what I'm talking about.
Well, let me see if I can squeeze in this last question from Hannah, who writes, I'm interested to know whether, with hindsight, she would have opted for a breast reduction surgery, even without the cancer gene. Does she like living with her new breasts better than her old ones?
That's a great question. So if you have the breast reduction surgery, that doesn't change your chance of getting breast cancer. If you're heredity-based breast cancer, you can have a lot of cells or a couple cells, and those still can mutate and have a higher chance of turning into a cancer cell. So for me, when I was younger, I was fantasizing about reduction before I knew I was even positive for the gene, because I hated these breasts and I thought, like, maybe in college, maybe after college, I'll get a reduction. But then I realized, like, if I had a reduction, I still would have that high risk. So I might still get cancer. I might still have to get a mastectomy. So instead of having multiple surgeries, I was like, oh, let me just design them this way. And I love them. Like, I feel better in my body without my breasts, which is so crazy. I feel strong. I feel good. I feel sexier. Like, I had no idea that, like, gaining control in this way would just make me feel lighter. I mean, they're lighter on my back. They're lighter in our relationship.
But also, it sounds like emotionally and mentally
yes.
lighter.
Yes. There's such an incredible peace. I mean, the doctors told me I had less than 1% chance of getting breast cancer. And that's just amazing.
Well, congratulations on the baby.
Thank you.
Boy that you're expecting.
A little guy, yeah.
Caitlin Brodnick, the book is Dangerous Boobies, Breaking Up With My Time Bomb Breasts. She speaks at Book Passage in Corte Madera tomorrow. And we're so happy that you came to speak with us today.
Thank you so much.
And thanks to our listeners for sharing their stories. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And our interns are Patrick Fitzgerald and Anna Sterla. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.